Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Tulku Sangnang Rinpoche and Anam Tupten Rinpoche. Anam Tupten is author of the book No Self, No Problem, and Tulku Sangnang Rinpoche just started a center, a meditation center here in Santa Fe called Pema Khandro Ling, which is at 1221 Louisa Street. And Richard Barron is here. He is their translator. Welcome, all of you, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I've been reading this book, No Self, No Problem, and in writing about spiritual practice, you use the word truth, and I'm wondering, what is spiritual truth compared to the truths that we're more familiar with, like scientific truth or legal truth?
Well, in Buddhism, we talk about the true truths, known as provisional truth and ultimate truth. The provisional truth is that truth is established by the collective mind, or the collective deluded mind, if I use a Buddhist concept. And then ultimate truth is the truth that has been realized by Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, the enlightened ones. So we call the truth here as the ultimate truth, truth as the way things are.
And so the truth that the rest of us ordinary people are familiar with, like the laws of gravity or things like that, or scientific truth that, legal truth that has to do with facts, we understand those things. Is it possible for people who are not realized, people who are listening to this show and trying to understand, to even have any sense of? In other words, can you give us some metaphors or ideas that point to what this ultimate truth is?
Well, the ultimate truth has many names in the Buddhist philosophy. Sometimes we call it emptiness or oneness, also no self as well. And according to the Buddhist teachings, everybody has the potential to realize the highest truth. But this ultimate truth can be, of course, talked about through theories, words, concepts, and logics. But there is a big difference between realizing the ultimate truth through concepts and experiencing it through a direct realization. And so Buddha said that the only way that one can discover the absolute freedom or the enlightenment is through having the direct experiential realization of the ultimate truth.
As I was reading your book, I was noticing that there's a kind of paradox, at least in the way that we talk about these things, which is, on the one hand, in order to realize truth, it's very much about staying where you are and noticing, being aware, cultivating awareness, and at the same time, we are so likely to use the metaphor of the journey. There's a path from here to there, and truth is a destination rather than something that is inherent at all times.
Well, let me go back to the original question. I feel that I haven't answered your question completely, because this is a huge subject. We can spend another 10 years. That's what monks do. They go to monastery for 10 years, trying to debate and have a dialogue to figure out what the truth is. So the truth that we're speaking about here is the underlying reality of all things. Basically, Buddhism teaches that most of the time we really don't live our life based on the perfect understanding of the reality or the way things are. Instead, we live out of illusions, mistaken perceptions of reality. In that sense, Buddhism teaches that every notion of reality that we are grasping at are actually just illusory, mind-produced phenomena. Buddhism even teaches that all these notions of phenomena, birth, death, separation, meeting, none of these do exist in the realm of the highest truth. Of course, this theory sounds very challenging, and especially someone who have never been exposed to those Eastern doctrines. This can be very challenging in the same way somebody who has never read quantum physics, it can be utterly challenging. But also it is true that individuals, especially in the path of meditation and spiritual practice, we all have a chance to experience the highest truth. And that's what we call the inner realization in the Buddhist tradition.
There's a lot of conversation in Buddhism about attachment and non-attachment. And what I'm wondering is, does it make sense for people to give up attachment to all things or just to useless and stupid things?
Well, Buddhism teaches the way to the liberation is through the path of attachment. And I think the very word attachment can be a little bit sometimes frightening to lots of people, because people think non-attachment as similar to detachment, that you close your heart and trying to ignore all the life's responsibility and also a form of escapism. But the path of non-attachment is not a form of spiritual escapism. Actually, it is a path of love and bliss. And so the practice of non-attachment will lead us to the greatest happiness, joy. So it's a very, blissful, ecstatic path once you really know what it means, not by intellect, but by heart. So Buddhism teaches a transcending attachment to everything.
Everything.
Yes.
Yeah, because I mean, in your book it says that we should look at giving up attachments to concepts like, I am poor. I can understand that. But then there's also concepts like, I am a woman or I am a man. I am a woman.
In some sense, you are a woman, but ultimately you are not a woman either. This can be very challenging, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I know, can be very challenging. So as a theory, this can be very challenging, but early Buddhist teachings talks about even transcending attachment to the notion of attainment. Attainment, like attainment, enlightenment, spiritual liberation. So there are many lines in the, especially Mahayana Buddhist tradition, constantly transcending attachment to everything, even the notion of attainment.
All of these things we're talking about, so many of us, we find them fascinating. We practice meditation. We still don't understand them on some deep level. But there is a real paradox in, on the one hand, the discipline of practice, and on the other hand, giving up the notion of attainment. Mm. Because why are you practicing?
Perhaps we could think of it this way. When we speak of a spiritual practice, such as a discipline of meditation, anything that partakes of that nature of being spiritual practice, we can approach it in this way. If I pursue my practice with too rigid or controlling a sense of what I'm supposed to be doing, that's actually going to limit or constrain my mind rather than produce the real benefits of spiritual practice. So to practice meditation is not forcing oneself to do something in a concentrated way. It means not being distracted. But in not being distracted, you're not fixating upon anything. So there's a balance there that I think may hold the key to that paradox.
The word karma is used very loosely. Everybody talks about karma. What does it mean?
Karma is a way of talking about the fact that until we have realized the ultimate truth that Anam Thubten Rinpoche was speaking about earlier, until we've actually come to the full-blown realization of that, what we experience is a process that has a certain infallibility to it. There are causes and there are effects. There are consequences to everything in the way we ordinarily experience things. And so our ordinary experience is driven a lot by habitual patterns in our minds that come from previous causes that continue to keep our mind in this cycle of ongoing existence as we know it, with our own individual interpretations of that, because of previous causes and conditions that can account for what we're now at present experiencing. So karma is just a way of describing that infallible process that we continue to experience until such time as we have realized the ultimate truth.
At which time karma is no longer operative?
It's a bit like going to sleep at night and dreaming. As long as we continue to be asleep, we can continue to have that dream. But the moment we wake up, there's no longer any context for that dream to play itself out.
In the story of the Buddha, you have a person who, if I understand the story or if I've heard it correctly, you have the story of a man who has lived many incarnations and who came to a lifetime in which he was ready for a spiritual path. And when I think of that story, I think of a tree with a fruit that slowly ripens and it finds this moment of ripeness, and that ripeness is the spiritual life that he lived and the teachings that he taught. But then I can't understand, I mean, do you have to go through this long process of ripening to be ready for that, or is it available to anybody at any time?
Oh, your questions are quite wonderful. Well, let me think about it for a few seconds. Can you give me a few
you
seconds?
Can have
because
all the
this
time
is a very profound question, something I don't know whether I'm ready to answer or not, because I can only answer what I know, but I cannot answer what I don't know. Well, according to Buddhist scriptures, there are two theories. One says that the Buddha was born as an ordinary human being, and another scripture says that Buddha was already quite exalted. So either way, Buddha found a great aspiration, like a zeal, to be on the spiritual path, and he realized that his highest passion, his highest desire in his life is liberation, not only finding path to liberation for himself, but for all humankind. So he just got that zeal. And it has causes. It is said, according to the Buddha's life story, that he lived in time in India, that there were lots of sufferings, but he was very much sheltered from the sufferings, physical suffering, mental suffering, like there were a lot of poverty, illness, the suffering was unavoidable, and he was exposed eventually to the suffering, the human condition. So witnessing this immense amount of human suffering actually almost gave rise to this zeal, spiritual zeal, this undying desire. So he was almost seized by that burning fire-like zeal, wanting to be enlightened. He didn't want anything else. So I believe that somehow, as a human being, even though we all have this extraordinary birthright we call Buddha nature, that means every human being, even every sentient being, has the potential to be enlightened. But somehow that potential has to be invoked by zeal, by aspiration, we call bodhicitta. And that aspiration tended to be sometimes triggered or sometimes ripened by interesting conditions, maybe realizing the suffering of humanity, or maybe just fed up with one's own suffering, or maybe run into extraordinary spiritual verses, or maybe, you know, running into that spontaneous spiritual talk happening in a coffee shop, just overheard it, and just that bodhicitta is activated. Then once you love the path, nobody can actually cleanse your mind. That's all you want. This is what happened to Buddha. He was basically abducted by this spiritual zeal. Yeah?
Yeah. Should we ask our other friend the same question?
It's not that we should think of this endless succession of rebirths or lifetimes to be somehow necessary or serving a purpose in and of itself. It is just that under certain circumstances, amidst all of that endless lifetime after lifetime that our mind experiences, there can be certain circumstances which, if we understand and relate to them properly, can trigger that transformation that Anantaptam Rinpoche was speaking about. So that can set us on the spiritual path. It's a question of whether we interpret those circumstances in that light or not. But I don't really see it as being somehow purposeful per se for the mind to just keep going through this endless process of lifetime after lifetime. It's not as though we're paying some dues so that then we get to attain enlightenment. But at any point, there could be that shift. So it's not as though there's any fixed pattern where after X number of lifetimes, then one has the opportunity to attain enlightenment. It's a bit like, think of it this way, suppose we're talking about the discovery of gold, not in a kind of historic sense, you know, mankind's discovery of gold, but just any individual finding gold. Some people go through a great deal of effort to dig it out of the ground and refine it and get the gold, and some people just trip over it walking down the street. They both get the gold.
Right.
In the same way, from the point of view of the Buddha Dharma, of the Buddha's teachings, there are many different means available to accommodate the needs, spiritual needs of different individuals. For some people, it'll be a very straightforward transformation, even virtually instantaneous. For other people, it might take a very long time for that transformation from an ordinary being to an enlightened being to come about. The point is not whether it's quick or slow, as long as the transformation takes place. It's still the gold. It's still attaining or getting the gold. So it's just a question of being able to accommodate the needs of those varying individuals.
In every society, it seems, in every time, there have been enlightened people, there have been saints, people who have great compassion, people who are living in ways that are selfless. And I look at that and I see that they seem to me like artists and musicians. They have a calling, they have a gift. And every generation there's a few of them, but none of them, even collectively, ever succeed in doing what the Buddha wanted, which was to give that gift to everybody. Every generation there's a few people who are enlightened and everybody else isn't, and then the next generation it's the same, and after that, and we're still doing war, and we're still poisoning the oceans and things like that. And is there any progress? Is progress even a concept that we should be thinking about in terms of this spiritual path?
To go back to this issue of karma, karma is something that we experience as individuals, but there's also a kind of collective dimension to the karma we share as human beings in this world, for example. That's one dimension of collective karma. And so we could think of it as there's a kind of reciprocal connection between what we contribute as individuals to the collective pool of our karma and how that collective pool of our karma also influences us as individuals. The more any group of individuals have in their minds counterproductive negative emotions of anger and hatred and so forth, the more that's contributing to a collective environment where something like war is that much easier to take place because the minds of the individuals are predisposed to that kind of action, that kind of activity. But given that there's this kind of collective dimension to the karma that we share in this world, all that can really be said is to the extent that the negative and afflictive emotions of possessiveness and greed and anger and jealousy and so forth motivate our individual minds, the more that is damaging the collective situation. It's worsening our collective karma. But that's always possible to reverse. It's always possible for that to change. But what that requires is a sufficient number of individuals in that collective group to turn their minds towards altruism, love, compassion, more positive emotions. So the more people of a group are contributing that kind of individual karma, the more that is benefiting and improving the collective dimension of our karma. So an individual's own personal karma can kind of go up and down, so to speak, but that also has an effect on the collective karma, which in turn creates a whole situation, a world we live in, where that can have an influence on our individual karma. So we can't really separate these two, but just note that there are these differences. So we find that certain individuals can act for what they deem to be in their best interests, but it involves them creating the circumstances for war or polluting the planet, so contributing in a very negative way to the collective situation. What's really necessary is for as many individuals as can to develop more and more positive emotions and feelings in their minds of altruism and love and compassion and so forth, to turn around that collective situation. Now, I want to go back to the early part of your question where you spoke of this possibility of all beings without exception, the Buddha's intention that all beings without exception gain enlightenment. That's something that we must cherish as our motivation, as what motivates us, the ideal, the goal being that. But the Buddhist teachings don't ever describe that, therefore there will come a time at such and such a point in time where that will happen. But it remains the ongoing ideal that we must aspire to individually as what motivates us to pursue our own spiritual practice and our own spiritual development. That goal of really being of benefit to others so that all others can partake of that at some point. But the Buddhist teachings don't really then speak in terms of, and then at some point, at this point in time, that will come about. And there's one part of your question that I haven't addressed yet. It was at the very end, you said something along the lines of, is it even realistic to aspire or hope for there being that outcome? So we could phrase it in another way. We could say, is it worth making the effort at all? Or should we just abandon any hope that all beings eventually are going to become enlightened? His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his speeches and talks and so forth, stresses again and again what he calls universal responsibility in a good heart. He talks about how we all have a contribution that's a very important contribution to make to our world. Particularly, he emphasizes in these modern times where there's this global village and where we're just all so interconnected that it's important for human beings to work to solve their problems harmoniously, effectively, to save the environment, to improve the human situation, because that's an extremely important contribution for us to make. So I would say we definitely have a responsibility to make those efforts. At the same time, we shouldn't have any naive hopes that will be dashed by circumstances, but just feel, I've done my part, so that we can live our life feeling, well, I've done my part. Come what may, I've really made the best contribution I can.
Anam Thubten, you write in your book, No Self, No Problem, an amazing thing. It says, when the self dissolves, everything is already awakened. Trees are awakened, rocks are awakened, birds are enlightened. When the Buddha had this moment of complete realization, he discovered that the whole universe is already enlightened. What does that mean?
Well, this is turned out to be the center theory as well as wisdom of Buddhist teachings, especially the higher teachings. And we use this word in Tibetan teachings, operating sacredness, which is quite actually very high transcendent thought.
Say that again.
All-pervading sacredness.
All-pervading sacredness.
There's a notion that everything is inherently sacred. Trees, rocks, birds, cloud in the sky, human beings. There's nothing that is not sacred. It means the intrinsic nature, the primordial ground of all things is sacred, is enlightened, whatever that means, of course. Then if you ask me what does sacred means, then that lead into another one, whatever month question, right? But that's the idea. What Buddha is saying, that there is a truth that our ego mind cannot comprehend. That's what he was saying all along. Not only that, when he was enlightened, he made a very famous statement. He said, I found a truth that is very subtle and profound, and no one would understand it. So he decided not to teach what he has realized for a long time. And after a while, he was approached by two individuals, and they encouraged him to teach. So he came out of his silence and started teaching, but he always felt all along his teaching career that there's a tremendous sense of a resistance from the collective mind to understand what he has discovered in his great awakening. So what Buddha was saying is that there is absolute truth, and that goes beyond our deluded mind. And Buddha said that all our problems, all our suffering, from major down to the minor, from collective level to the individual level, come from what he called primordial ignorance. Avidya in Sanskrit, primordial ignorance. Literally, it means not knowing what the truth is. So which actually brought back to the earlier conversation that we had. When he said the truth means dvaitansar, what he is indicating is that most of the time we don't really see dvaitansar. So we are deluded, we are completely lost in this virtual world that our deluded mind created. And then we are experiencing the dreamlike, nightmare-like suffering, birth, death, separation, failure, success, but none of these do exist. So therefore he discovered the whole our problem, this nightmare-like problem. I don't think most people think that way. So anyway, but definitely there's a fundamental problem our human life, existential anguish, anxiety. Everyone is going through some form of existential anguish, right? The fear of death or insecurity, either those invisible demons come out on the surface of consciousness or not. It is another matter. But so he said all these problems come from the primordial ignorance. And opposite of the primordial ignorance is knowing the truth. But then what is truth? Well, Buddha himself used many non-conceptual words. Words are very limited. We can throw hundreds of words. We can only point out to a direction of the truth, but you have to glimpse it, you have to experience it. Words are not enough. So after Buddha, we also come up with many words to describe the truth that Buddha was speaking about. And I have been using basically more Tibetan Buddhist notion of all-pervading sacredness, which is another synonym for the truth. I don't think this concept, this word, is used by other Buddhist traditions like Zen or Theravadan Buddhism, as far as I know, but Tibetan Buddhism uses this language. It's, to me, it's very poetic, very positive, it's very blissful terminology to me, this notion that the ultimate truth is, yes, we call emptiness, but it's also this all-pervading sacredness, means everything sacred, everything is ultimately enlightened as it is, and there's no suffering, there's no problem, there's no delusion, there's no coming and going, there's no limitations, and the perfect sphere of that enlightened reality, which is the underlying reality of all things, the all-pervading sacredness. We call it all-pervading sacredness because that primordial sacredness, the perfection of perfection, the godliness, that tricky word, right? It's not really Buddhist word, but there's sacredness that pervades upon everything. Mm-hmm.
There's a question I have about the role of morality. Morality has a role in Buddhism. There are moral precepts that followers are asked to follow. At the same time, morality practice in ignorance can become rigid, and Lord knows that the United States culture is full of people bashing each other over the head with morality. What is the proper way to think about morality?
If we go back to what the Buddha had to say on questions of morality and ethics, and he had a lot to say, it seems to me that it stands in contradiction to the way a lot of what passes for morality nowadays is being understood. Because one can use morality as a, if I can use an example, as a telescope to look at others as though they were distant from one, separate from one, and you're sort of using that telescope of morality to look at them and judge them. That's not how I understand morality from the Buddha's perspective and from the perspective of the Buddhist tradition. Morality and ethics are to be guidelines so that we can establish some checks and balances regarding our own shortcomings. So it's a way of self-correction when we see our own shortcomings as individuals, not to be some kind of instrument to be used to judge what may or may not be the faults and shortcomings of others. So the difference, as I see it, from the Buddhist perspective, to what you brought up as the kind of more common way in which morality is being used nowadays often, is that it's to be applied only in your own situation. It only really counts what you feel about how you act and how you behave and that kind of self-correction process. Think of it this way. It's rather than using the telescope, you're using it like a mirror. And the mirror is to hold up to your own face to see what's what, to see where the strengths and weaknesses lie. But if we use morality as a vehicle to excuse our judging other people, all we're going to see is flaws in others because we're already predisposed to be judging them from our own supposedly moral standard. So from the Buddhist point of view, that doesn't work at all.
What about in raising children?
As a parent, I'm aware of the fact that we have a great responsibility as parents to inculcate good values in our children. One of my own teachers, Dingo Chensi Rinpoche, used to compare the state of early childhood to the state of a pool of clear water. And he said, if the water is just kind of resting there by itself, we have an image for the child's mind as being something that is still fairly uninfluenced in one direction or another, positive or negative. But at any point, the water could be led in one direction or another. And it might be led in some direction where it's going to become very polluted, and gradually, drop by drop, the entire body of water is going to head in that direction. Or it could be guided in a much more positive direction where it will remain clean and pure. So it's an understanding that the minds of young children are very, very malleable, very easily influenced one way or the other. And so it becomes a great concern for us as parents to ensure that our children are exposed to the kinds of influences that will be beneficial to them and to others so that they will be able to lead good and productive lives. This is behind a parent's desire for their child to, for example, get the best education and find the best teachers and so forth. And also what's behind, ideally, parents training their children well. Not imposing, but exposing their children to influences, because the children will be exposed to some influence or another, and their minds are very open to those influences. So the responsibility of parents is to make sure that those are good influences.
I want to go back to something that we talked about earlier, and this whole question of the human body, you know, the idea that on some level I am a female person and on some level I'm not. But in a very real way, all we have is the body. Once we're gone, we don't know what happens after that. We have many theories about it. The Buddha tells us things about it, but all we really know is what we know from the inside of this experience of being inside of flesh. And there is an argument to be made for the beauty of the life cycle. We're born, we live, we mature, we get old, we die, just like every leaf and like every flower. Why should we want to transcend that? We experience pleasure, we experience pain. Is that not enough?
To answer that question, I have to begin by stating that from a Buddhist perspective, to understand things from a Buddhist perspective, you need to understand that what that's based upon is an acceptance of a continuity of mind from one lifetime to the next, so that this lifetime here and now is not the only lifetime in a body that this mind of ours has experienced. There have been many before, there will be others. There's a continuity of mind from one physical embodiment to another. So the only way you can understand something from a Buddhist perspective is to understand that that's axiomatic. That's kind of a given. Now, having said that, that continuity is not on the more conventional level so fixed that a woman is always reborn as a woman or a man is always reborn as a man. Our gender in this lifetime is something that's specific to this lifetime because of the particular causes and conditions that produced this lifetime. But that doesn't mean that that's a fixed principle in any absolute sense that's always going to be the case. Because mind in and of itself is neither male nor female, which isn't to say that there aren't masculine and feminine traits to consciousness, but consciousness pure and simple, mind pure and simple, in and of itself is neither male nor female. So under circumstances, we have been born into this life in physical bodies that are of one gender or another, and we identify with that, and we say, I'm a woman or I'm a man in this lifetime. And Rinpoche said, I know there's all kinds of theories about masculine psychology and feminine psychology, but these are more circumstantial than fundamental or absolute. And a lot of them are based upon the most superficial of assumptions. For example, you could say, and many cultures and many schools of thought say, well, men are more aggressive. The male psychology is more geared towards aggression, whereas the feminine is more geared towards desire and home and providing a nest and nurturing and ownership. And so you can make all these kinds of claims. But they really don't constitute any kind of definitive statement one way or the other. There are plenty of men who have lots of desire and plenty of women with lots of anger. So it's not you can't make these flat statements about people because of their gender and say it's always going to be one way or the other. So that's one aspect of your question. The second concerns this whole purpose or need to transcend the natural cycles of things. Well, if this world we lived in were a perfect world, if those natural cycles produced no problems and no pain and no suffering for anyone, that would be one thing. But anybody who's part of this completely natural cycle still experiences, as a result of that, part and parcel with that, some form of suffering and pain, which is an unwanted experience. And again, from the Buddhist perspective, the Buddha wasn't speaking just of human beings, but all life forms, all sentient life. And so the various descriptions in the traditional teachings of the six classes of beings and so forth are a way of indicating this multiplicity of life. And so the need to transcend these natural cycles is, from an individual's perspective, ideally to be one of transcending all of that suffering and also helping others to do the same. You use the example of something like a tree, the life cycle of a tree and the life cycle of human beings and so forth. There being parallels there. Just as there's no guarantee that a male is always going to be reborn as a male, there's not necessarily any guarantee that a human is always going to be reborn a human. Because our individual fates, if you want to use that word, our individual destinies as beings in this world can go up and down in any number of circumstances, and we might be reborn in one lifetime into very positive and pleasant circumstances, and in another lifetime, under the ordinary process of rebirth, be reborn in a much more difficult situation with a lot more pain and suffering. There's a kind of relentless quality to this cycle of life that does pose a problem, particularly if we don't think of it simply as our own personal search to be released from that suffering, but see it as, again, an expression of our responsibility to help others. Because from the Buddhist perspective, what the problem with this cycle of ordinary existence is that it limits us. It limits our mind's ability to be of real benefit to others. And the more we can transcend the limitations of that ordinary cycle of conditioned existence, the more we can make a much more significant contribution to the welfare of others, human and otherwise. And so when we think of the power of the individual to change things in a much bigger perspective, when we think of spiritual leaders such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I'm simply referring to him as one who's familiar to me, there are many others, or someone like Nelson Mandela, someone who by their example and by their presence on this planet as individuals make a huge difference. That's because to some extent or another, they've gone beyond the limitations of that ordinary cycle of existence and are that much more free and able to help others. So it's not so much thinking, why would I even think of having to transcend this perfectly natural cycle? It's a way of seeing the limitations of that cycle and saying, the more I transcend it, the more I can be of benefit to others in helping them free themselves.
I think I have to defend my book, and you brought this very wonderful question about transcendence. Let me give a little bit of comment. So Rinpoche gave me a little bit of time to reflect together my thought, because this is quite interesting, fascinating, and also very transcending subject to. In all spiritual traditions, there's this sense of this absolute union. And in Hinduism, they talk about a union with the Brahma, and which is their understanding of enlightenment and liberation. So, but there was a little bit mistake in a lot of those Indian spiritual practices, because they believe that the final hindrances to experience that absolute union with the Brahma or the divine force, is that the body is very sinful. So they're talking about the Atma and the Brahma. Brahma is the divine being or the divine energy. Atma is the higher self. So they believe that when the Atma, your higher self, finally unite with the Brahma, the universal creative energy or the source of love, then you're free. But somehow this human body, which is inherently sinned and impure, is like a cage, somehow trapping the bird like your higher consciousness to be in union with the Brahma. Buddha rejected that because Buddha thought that was actually totally mistaken philosophy, because out of that philosophy, a lot of self-torturing ascetic practice come into your being. So Buddha taught the middle path, which is based on actually respect to the body. Respect to your body, respect to your sense of being as a woman or man. So this idea of transcending all your identities, like being woman and man, has nothing to do with really denying the body. Actually, it is the opposite of it. Because through this transcendence that Buddha was talking about, finally we're able to live life fully and finding and joy and happiness, ultimate bliss. In Buddhism, we also talked about different levels of paradise. We talked about paradise that you can be reborn in the next lifetime, but also we talk about this notion of for example, Akanishita means the highest paradise. The idea is that once you're free from all your inner veils, all your inner obscuration, you can be actually liberated to the extent that you can experience living this human life is like if you're walking in this the highest paradise. So Buddhism doesn't really reject the body at all, but I'd like to answer your question, because I know this is very shocking, right? When you heard the first time, or anybody heard first time, that or being woman or being man are merely concepts, it's very shocking. But our mind has to be shocked in order to deeply engage with meditation, reflect on the true meaning of the Buddha's teachings. Well, Buddhism use lots of methods to shock our mind, so when our mind is shocked, we lose our grip onto the old notion of reality, our attachment to hope, fear, etc. So also Buddhism uses lots of techniques like reflection, meditation, and one of the prayers we use in a Buddhist tradition, especially Tibetan Buddhist tradition, is that we always pray, may I recognize my primordial face, Tomi Rangajal in Tibetan. So it shows that there's a primordial face, which means our true nature. And our true nature goes beyond birth and death. It's unborn, it's never going to die. Our true nature is never bound to circumstances. Actually, I think this very extraordinary person who is sitting next to me, Rukhsang Rinpoche, is somebody who realized his primordial face, because I don't know whether he's going to share his personal anecdote with me or not, but one time he was locked up in a communist concentration camp because he's very high lama, and then he shared his deep spiritual journey with me. There was a point that in which that he felt that nothing really mattered to him, nothing bound him. He transcended all limitations like anger, judgment. He found a sense of utter freedom. So that's why
in prison.
Yes, that's why this notion of primordial face is that your true nature that is not bound to any circumstances, because circumstances are unpredictable, right? Sometimes you're young, sometimes you're old, sometimes people love you, sometimes people hate you, sometimes your belly is full, sometimes you're hungry. You can't rely on the circumstances, right? If you rely on the circumstances, you're in a big trouble, because then there's no any solid ground of happiness or freedom at all. So that your true nature, primordial face is free from everything, and yet it is really who you are. And then because that, all these ideas of who you are, like being woman, being young, being old, being male, being tall, short, smart, intelligent, these are really just ideas, just I call fake ideas.
Well, I was thinking about that once. I was going through a period of great turmoil, and I felt very lost in my own life and was trying to find my direction. And I started thinking about monks. Yes. And there you are. There's this funny paradox between, on the one hand, these are the people who have the greatest opportunity to seek no self. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there you are. Everybody's got a shaved head. Everybody's got a place to go. They have a shared language, shared prayers, shared rituals, the monastery, the community. And what would they be without those? I mean, is that not in itself the danger of being a kind of false security and identity and attachment?
Well, of course, that can happen. But as idea when you go to Buddhist monastery is that you are going to enter into the Buddhist training or the Buddhist path by holding this thought. We call it the most precious thought. There was a great saint, a Buddhist saint in India, whose name is Shandindar. He said, there are many thoughts in human consciousness. The most precious thought that you can welcome into the house of your consciousness is the bodhicitta. Bodhicitta means the enlightened heart, but actually is the aspiration that I was talking about, the zeal, is that you want to realize your primordial face or realize the enlightenment or the Buddhahood. So that's all we can do. We just try to do our best to hold in that precious thought, not lose it. And then beyond that, as Rinpoche says, it's all dependent on individuals. Some people are going to find the gold immediately, and some people are not going to find the gold. Not only that, they will be lost in the process of seeking the gold.
For our new friend, Tulku Sangnang Rinpoche, how did you decide to open a center here in Santa Fe, New Mexico?
Well, I could take the easy way out and just say it's my karma. But I could go into it a bit more than that. There's a bit of personal history here, because when I first came to the United States more than a decade ago, one of the first projects that I undertook was in the Santa Fe area, and that was the building of what is called a stupa, which is, I mean, you can think of it as a monument, but it's a Buddhist structure that has a great deal of significance, of spiritual significance. And so in a plot of land just outside of Santa Fe, I was asked to come and direct the building of this stupa, and that brought me back here time and again over several years. And I found that, if nothing else, I just really enjoyed the environment here. I just really liked the area. I then went on to found a center in Montana, in a very rural area of Montana, which is, you could say, my main center in a sense. But a number of other factors kind of drew me back to Santa Fe. I was given the land that the stupa is on. I'm now a father, and I have to think about the schooling of my children, and it's much easier here to find good schools than it was where we were in Montana. So a number of different circumstances came together. In the Buddhist context, we have this word temdral in Tibetan, which means interdependence. A number of different factors come together, and you sort of can see the significance of those factors as being meaningful. And so for me, the Santa Fe area provided all kinds of temdral, all kinds of circumstances that came together, which led me to think that it would be a good idea to move here, to move my family here, and also to found a center. So everything's turned out quite well. And so it made sense, since I was going to be spending more time here, to found a center. It's a very modest center. We don't have huge aspirations at this point. We have a small place where people can meet, and we can have programs of just a few days where a number of people can come together and study the teachings and so forth. So for now, things are going very well, and I'm very happy to be here.
I want to thank you all very much, Tulku Sangnang Rinpoche and Anam Thubten Rinpoche. The latter is the author of the book No Self, No Problem. And the new center here in Santa Fe, or the centers actually everywhere, can be found at ewam.org. That's ewam.org. And thank you, Richard Barron, translator. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.